Hello and welcome to Oscar Mike Radio, this special edition. My name is Travis, Marine Corps veteran and your host. Oscar Mike Radio is sponsored by Joyce Asak of Asak Real Estate and Echo 6 Ranch Creations. Thank you, Danielle Rocco. I want to thank my supporters, Kason Shaving Company, Exceptional Parent Magazine, and Fight Camp. Be your strongest combination. As we talk about this combination of family, friends, and country for J.J. Millett, part two of J.J. Strong. And I'm with a special guest tonight, his cousin, Elizabeth Dubois, who is really going to give us a perspective about this because, amongst other things, she is a professor, an expert in cybersecurity, and domestic terrorism, as you will find out. Elizabeth, welcome to Ask Mike Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm very happy to be here to discuss not only JJ as a family member, but also the behind the scenes kind of look at what Homeland Security experts would really mirror and see in this case.
So just to catch everybody up, because, and I'll have the link to part one in this website post and part two, but your mother reached out to me, Emily, and said, "Hey, my nephew served in the Army National Guard, had some, you know, issues, and was being seen by VA care, and in February had an incident, and now is being brought up on charges of domestic terrorism and could be in jail for 20 years. You know, what can we do?" And it seemed what could have been a fantastic story of everything working has turned into this legal quagmire really quick. So, like I asked, you know, his sister, Courtney, you know, what do you know about the man, the cousin, JJ, and what does he mean to you?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So he obviously is my cousin. He is one of the kindest people you will ever meet. He would give the shirt off his back to pretty much anyone. And I've, since this case began, and I've been doing public outreach and social media posts, I've had former inmates from his time as a correctional officer reach out to me. They did a message to vent like you would typically expect. They messaged to share how JJ was different, how he treated them with dignity they hadn't seen from others in the system. He is deeply devoted to family. And my earliest memories of him are defined by his service in the military. So when he came back from Afghanistan in 2011, I'm trying to do math, I was 13. So I remember praying at night that he would return safe. And when he did come home, he actually brought me a stuffed bear with a little army uniform on it. And it sits on my bookcase right by my desk. And that really represents kind of the limited worries I was allowed to have as a child and still am allowed to have today, because of people like JJ, those that are willing to carry the country's worries on their soldiers on kind of on their head and kind of on their body, so we don't have to. And kind of fast forward now, as a professor of Homeland Security and cybersecurity, I know that I'm here with the freedoms, the education, security I enjoy because of JJ. And I'm here because of those that do go to war and serve this country, so I don't have to. So that's a little about him.
So you got to watch him and Courtney, you know, be brother and sister. This meant a lot to you. You were very happy as a 13-year-old with him coming home. And it seems like, talking to your mother, that, you know, the whole family, you were a tight family, and Derby is a very, you know, close-knit community in Vermont. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, my father, his uncle is one of five. And again, you lose touch over the years, but when something happens, you're always there. And that's what family ultimately is. And that community is very tight-knit, as is actually mine in New York, but it's very hard to find that sense of community where everyone has each other's backs. And that is exactly what we have in the Northeast Kingdom.
I do cybersecurity. I'm not in the, you know, terrorism side of it, so to speak. I know of it because of cyber threats. But what got me when, you know, your mom reached out to me and I started looking at this is okay, you know, what actually happened that this had to rise to the level of being charged with domestic terrorism? Because as I understand, and for people who didn't see part one, is he had an event. He said he heard voices and wanted to hurt himself and other people. And this came out of the clear blue. He called the 988 number, got connected to help there. They referred this to the Vermont State Police, and he drove and surrendered himself, his firearm and his, you know, pocket knife, utility knife, to the state police and got into VA care. And then while he was in VA care, he was charged with this crime. And then I'm reading the news links that you all sent me, and it was like, you know, the police found this, you know, manifesto, and this manifesto was what led the Essex County attorney to file charges. And then I'm hearing that that's not actually the case. And I think people are very confused about why the prosecution went this way. And I was wondering if you shed some light on what actually happened, because I learned that what actually happens and what the news media reports and what the prosecution links are three very different things.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I wish I could make sense of this case myself. But yeah, so basically what happened is kind of from the professional security standpoint, I'm going to take a step back from being the cousin of JJ and just look at it objectively. So we usually evaluate risk through capability and intent. And JJ is a trained soldier. He possessed the capability, but he lacked the fundamental intent required to define a terrorist under the law. Again, obviously, my law differs than what really is the domestic terrorism charges being brought against him. But in our field, we study the pathway to violence. So this is marked by ideological radicalization and a deliberate desire to cause some type of harm, whether political, social. In late February, JJ wasn't on this pathway to violence. He had a chemical malfunction, as you said. He experienced a documented psychiatric crisis. So this was an episode that was actually triggered by a horrible reaction to a new VA prescribed medication. And I've spoken to colleagues in the legal and national security fields, and the consensus is still of disbelief. I've laid out the facts, and they're really at a loss, as I'm sure a lot of the public is as well, as how the facts, which I'll present, have escalated to the domestic terrorism charge.
Because so, I understand it. The Vermont State Police looked at this and said at the time, you know what? This appears to be a mental health crisis that was resolved peacefully. And, you know, the veteran called for help, got help, and is being compliant with treatment. There's no reason to charge.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so the state's points to the threats made on the 988 call, but they are in terms really ignoring the clinical context of that. So JJ didn't call the Veterans Crisis Line to make threats. He called because his mind was failing him. When the counselor on the other end probed him with questions, who do you want to harm? He answered with honesty, which you would hope happens on a call like that. When he told troopers that voices were telling him to harm people, he immediately followed it with a plea. I hope God keeps me from obeying. I do not know what to do. As a security expert, that in and of itself is a man reported symptoms of this crisis, not intentions. So basically, if you think about it, if you tell a doctor your chest hurts, you aren't threatening to have a heart attack. You are asking for intervention to prevent one. So what the state's trying to do is to rebrand this medical crisis as a criminal confession. We often know people call a crisis line for one reason and one reason only. It is for intervention. You don't call a recorded government lifeline to hide a plot. You call because you are internally probably losing the battle with your own mind and you need a circuit breaker. So in the state's attempt to treat JJ's honesty as a confession, the state is effectively claiming that seeking help is an admission of guilt on its own, which really undermines various laws, but really the principles of due process. So that's really the challenge with the call itself.
And just to be clear, as I understand it, and, you know, I did my looking around, and JJ has no prior convictions at all.
No, not at all.
He's not on any current domestic terrorist watch list, either 6 months ago or before this happened.
No, like I said, he was a corrections officer for years after return from Afghanistan. And obviously, like I said, inmates reach out to me about how wonderful of a man. You'd be hard up to find someone that knew JJ, whether in past or present, that doesn't think that of him.
So you've done work with the Department of Homeland Security. You teach us as a professor. Again, separate him being a family member and a cousin. If he's, there's no marker that I would think that would classify him or profile JJ as a terrorist on his face.
Yeah, no, like I said, there's nothing. So the state's argument obviously hinges on that call, which of itself is a very gray area. But then they say he was tracked to a parking lot in Newport, which he sat in for under 2 minutes. They've painted a picture of a man in tactical gear with dangerous weapons. So the facts of the story, which are not being reported in the media or by the state, is he had no tactical gear. He doesn't even own any, and none was found. He had legal carry, so he had a revolver in the car with him and a jackknife, items that many veterans and many Vermonters typically travel with, so that's nothing to be shocked about. And the big thing is, at the peak of his psychotic break or episode, JJ did not reach for a rifle, a gun. He reached for a phone. He sought a controlled environment specifically to ensure that these weapons stayed silent.
Well, and that's the thing too, because a lot of times, you know, this doesn't end this way, veteran or not. When it's like this, it's usually like, hey, I've already made the decision to end my life. You know, I'm done. But he wanted help and surrendered peacefully. I'm like, you don't surrender peacefully if you're trying to hurt somebody. Am I wrong there?
And that's exactly the big thing here. So after speaking with the troopers, because the 988, the crisis line, they called the state troopers because he did make claims to harm himself or others. And they did exactly what they should have done. They alerted the police, which is great because you want to ensure public safety. Sure. And then the cops came in and tried to defuse the situation. Again, their job. But what came after is, after the police deemed him no longer a threat to the public, he should have been directly kind of brought for medical attention. And that should have been the end of it if he was honestly seeking treatment. So he, after speaking with the troopers, the police asked JJ to drive himself to the barrack. If the state truly considered him an active domestic terror threat at that moment, they never would have allowed him to get behind the wheel of a car and drive to them. He surrendered to the state police barracks, disarmed himself, and surrendered for mental health evaluations. There's no, terrorists do not seek out police stations to hand over their weapons. And he chose a hospital bed and even stayed in the VA psychiatric center for an entire month to be stable. And that is not any sign of being a terrorist.
I just want to go back to the Vermont State Troopers' involvement and response to this, because I'm like, wow, they could have escalated this. They could have, you know, called the SWAT team and, you know, had guns pointed at him. But it seemed like they talked him into just coming down. Hey, we're going to help you out. I mean, how important was that? Because that seems to be the exception, not the norm sometimes.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like I said, everything followed kind of the playbook, and they did what they should have done in a mental health crisis, from the 988 crisis line to the police intervening. And again, this could have went 50 different ways, but we're thankful in a way that until that point, it went that way. But as you said, a few days after being in the hospital seeking treatment, he got served papers and the charges of domestic terrorism. And then since then, we've been trying to piece everything together on what leg they have to stand on to make this case.
So one thing that comes to that I get asked a lot is, well, these journals, because it's my understanding they found his journals, and there must have been some kind of really harmful stuff in those journals, and it came off as a manifesto. But listening to your mom and Courtney, they're like, well, that was his VA journals for therapy. And I don't get mental counseling from the VA. I get health, but even I've been encouraged to keep a journal of my health and how I'm feeling in case I need to talk to him about that. What were those things that they're speaking of when it came out as a manifesto?
I said, when he was, after he surrendered at the police station, he told a family friend who happened to be an on-duty officer to retrieve a legal weapon that was on his table at his home. At that point, they searched the house, found a notebook where JJ had written about a mass casualty event being the solution to a world of misery that exists. The state pulled that one line out of a host of spiritual reflections and labeled it a manifesto, which was since overturned in court. That the judge did say that it cannot be labeled a manifesto. It does not reach that status. As a researcher, I understand the value of data, but the big thing here is what the precedent sets is the dangerous weaponization of healthcare. So these were not terrorist plans. They were mandated, or not necessarily mandated, but they were therapeutic tools that the VA and a lot of psychiatrists actually recommend to their patients to process PTSD, to process what was seen and heard while serving this country. And JJ was doing exactly what the VA says, get the darkness out of your head onto paper so you can process this, so we can process it.
It's one of the first things that we're told to do is to journal. It's a big part of the VA's and mental health component.
And even before he served, he would journal. He almost like a diary.
Courtney said he was a good writer. He's a good writer. Yeah.
He's a phenomenal writer, and really? He would write down all his thoughts into journals. And then obviously coming back from Afghanistan, he would obviously amped up and tried to write down more because he tried to process what went on over there and to really take that private medical recovery and his religious reflections and rebrand them as a criminal plot is a clinical betrayal. And again, there's a lot of kind of private struggles in this, and they're turning those private struggles into state evidence. So this in turn is really sending a message to every service member that your recovery is now a liability.
So that's, before we get into the final part of this, this is the thing I want to kind of, ask you about. You have studied, taught, and worked in Homeland Security to prevent terrorists from attacking the U.S. or understand what to do when they do. What happens when that law enforcement first responder, that military veteran, that active duty service member says, you know what, I'm not right and I need help. And then they see this and say, you know what, this is not worth my good name, my career, or my freedom. This is gonna have a domino effect in your opinion, right?
I don't even know where to begin. This is going to set a precedent that I wish would stick to just the Northeast Kingdom, but it is going to quickly domino across this country. If one veteran is afraid to call, that's too much in my book. That call line, that crisis line, it is there for a reason and should be a safe place for veterans or people in mental health crisis to be able to call to hopefully walk them off the edge. And what this is saying, if these charges carry through and he does actually get charged as a domestic terrorist, what this is telling every single veteran across this country is it's not safe to call. It's not safe to get help. You have to suffer alone. And that's going to lead to the worst case scenarios for so many of the people that we have relied on to give us our level of security.
It's extremely worrisome to me that it's being done like this. And I'm going to keep my personal feelings out of this for now, but to me, I'm like, you sit there and tell veterans and first responders, hey, I've had shows about the 988, helpline and the Mass Health helpline for this reason. And you know, this comes back to a situation that happened in West Roxbury where the veteran drove in the parking lot and wound up, you know, a bad conclusion to the issue. And I didn't want to see that happen again. And I just keep seeing where I need help. You tell people to ask for help and now they're being punished for it. I don't understand the long-term complications of this if this continues.
And the sad thing in all of this is in security governance, which I teach, we advocate for clinical first approaches. JJ really? Followed every protocol established for
this could have been a crisis. This could have been a very, this could have been like a success. The process worked.
Yeah, it could have been a success story. He reached out to the VA. He contacted the 998 crisis line. He followed police instructions, surrendered his weapons. But if the state rewards that level of transparency with domestic terrorism charges, they're not just prosecuting JJ. They are really dismantling the very safety nets we have spent decades as a country trying to build. And again, it's basically saying that this lifeline that we say is out there is actually a trap. And that is not what we want to say. And that's not the message we want to speak to our service members.
I'm getting asked, and I wanted to kind of get you on so it would come from you and not from me, but I'm getting asked, hey, you know, Travis, what can we do to help out, you know, JJ, you know, his family and the people in Vermont who are trying to rally for him? You know, when we want you to know that he's not alone, but what can we do? Because we're rolling up our sleeves getting ready to help.
Yeah, no, like I said, that's definitely a great question. I guess the biggest message I want people to take away from JJ's case is that public security and human empathy are not mutually exclusive. That is something that is very, I don't know why that's being so hard to understand at this point, but we can and must keep community safe. That's 100% the goal, but we have to do so without destroying the lives of those who have sacrificed everything to serve us. So, again, the big thing is to share. So we really have to get the word out there. We need to do better to really show that JJ is not a threat to national security. He's a victim of a system that's currently failing to distinguish between a soldier in pain and an enemy of the state. And we need to do that not just for JJ, but for the hundreds and thousands of veterans that are watching this case right now. They're looking at Vermont to see if it's truly safe to ask for help or if this safe harbor is actually an illusion. And that really leads to kind of the sad thing as a professor. It's actually really hard to teach right now because I'm like the laws, the justice system I teach about, I don't know if I believe in at this point in time. If we criminalize the honesty that's required to survive a psychiatric crisis, the lifeline of the 988 crisis line is no longer a resource. And the true threat to our national security is this prosecution carrying through. It's not JJ. It's not veterans that are in a mental health crisis. It is the fact that the justice system is serving up domestic terrorism charges to these people. So I'm actually drafting a bill right now to present to the state of Vermont and to federal government to hopefully ensure that the promises to our service members are not just spoken or written, they're actually acted on. And this hopefully will protect them on the legal side if this were to happen again. My goal would be never to see this in the news again. But if it was, I'm hoping that I can get some buy-in from some politicians to really make sure this is cemented into law.
I have to ask, have any of the Vermont politicians, reached out or been a help to you all? No, not really.
No, like I said, well, I've had a very tough time. And to be honest, a lot of the politicians, I think, are holding their breath to see what the outcome is. And then they will jump on if it's a good outcome. And then if not, they're going to kind of shake loose of it. Like I said, I've been extremely disappointed. Like I've reached out to some politicians here in New York. Again, it's state level, so they didn't really have much they could do in New York State for a Vermont state case, but they're going to look into it. But the sad thing is what we've seen across the country is injustices only thrive in the dark. So the most important thing that you can do is share JJ's story. We need to really bring this into the light. I hate to say this because it's a double-edged sword, because showing this case is going to make people fearful to call for help. But at the same time, if we don't let veterans, citizens, policymakers understand what is at stake, we may lose the very trust that, or the little trust that's left that our veterans place in us. So it's time to really stop treating a veteran's scars as a crime. And really that honor that they earn by serving this country is something we really need to respect more. There's all these services and kind of ceremonies out there, but unless you can back that up with laws and protections, and especially the scars from mental health crisis, there, I find it kind of a mute point.
Myself and my you know, veteran family are, you know, going to magnify this. I've never met JJ, never met you, but it just seemed like when your aunt reached out that first time that, okay, this is time to band together like veterans have in the past and show that we're not going to be, you know, just pushed around. So we'll keep sharing, we'll keep amplifying, and I look forward to talking to the next person to keep this going, Elizabeth, because if this happens once, it can happen again, and then it's never going to stop, and you're going to have people just, you know, choose a different pathway. And the fact of the matter is, your cousin's still with us. He's still here, and I just hope this has a happy ending.
Yeah, no, like I said, if we obviously do as well, but the big thing is the precedent. And as JJ said before, obviously he does care about the outcome for himself, but the bigger thing is he does not want this to happen to another veteran. He's like, it's no man left behind on the battlefield in war zones. Why do we have to leave them behind when we come back? And that is not okay. In my book, like I said, I've been doing a lot more research than I'm used to really dive into kind of what's out there for veteran protections. And there is very little.
Wow.
That, so.
Well, again, we're going to keep this going. We're going to amplify on our end. We are here for you, and you know, for what it's worth, he's not alone as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, we're right here with you all and your family. And just thank you for sharing with us tonight. And I'm looking forward to talking with you again as this progresses, Elizabeth.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate it.
So look, ladies and gentlemen, it's just as simple as sharing and sharing again, so people know about this. If we as Americans come together for this veteran, then this miscarriage of justice cannot continue. I'm Travis Lask, Mike Radio. Elizabeth, thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
We're Mission in Flight. We'll see you next time.